From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 714, Genomic-Style Cloud Data Analysis Pipelines, with guest Lynn Langit. Recorded Friday, July 10th, 2020. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts, LLC. For more information, visit soundthoughtsllc.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell. Thanks for listening to Run As Radio. My guest today is Lynn Langit, who is a cloud architect who codes. She's a Microsoft Regional Director, a Google Developer Expert, and an AWS Community Hero. And Lynn specializes in big data projects. She has worked with AWS Athena, Aurora, Redshift, Kinesis, and the IoT. She's also done production work with Databricks for Apache Spark and the Google Cloud Dataproc, Bigtable, BigQuery, and Cloud Spanner. And she's the author of a number of LinkedIn learning videos on these subjects. And Lynn is also the co-founder of Teaching Kids Programming. She has spoken on data and cloud technologies all over the world. Hi, Lynn.
Hello. How are you today, Richard?
I'm good. I mean, we've known each other for years and years, but boy, look at this repertoire of accreditation, an RD, a GDE, and an AWS Community Hero. Like, that's a heck of a combination.
Well, you know, curiosity killed the architect. hopefully not the client, you know?
Well, and the demand for folks who can pull value out of this vast amount of data we have hanging around these days. I'm sure you're very popular.
Yeah, professionally, I'm in a very advantageous spot, which I really, really recognize, particularly in these challenging times.
All tech folks that I talk to, for the most part, are super busy, and we're all being kind of, you know, because not everybody is. Lots of people are struggling, but the demand for technology is huge.
Yes, indeed. I'm in the point now in my career where I am working with people newer to these technologies. I call them my interns or my grad students, really, is what they are. And I often have so much request for work that as my grad students gain real-world skills, they then get jobs, you know, yeah. Contracts turn into jobs. So, you know, it's a small impact, but you know, every little impact, I think, is important now.
But that's got to be a great thing for you. Each time someone who's working with you gets to a place where they are needed elsewhere in the industry, that's a win, really.
Yeah, it's been really fun. Again, I've done so many things in my life that are either backwards or unexpected. I joke that I had this ambition when I was younger to be a college professor, mm-hmm. but it just never went that way. But I sort of am now because my daughter is that age. And so right. I do. I literally have 4 or 5 grad students because I just corral her friends, my poor kid. But, you know, it does usually benefit in, you know, economic advantage for them. So it's not all bad.
Yeah, no, that totally works out as well. And you've been doing work related to the pandemic?
Yeah, you know, it's just been a really doubly bizarre year. And we'll probably get into it in the conversation. But mm-hmm. I had been working on helping personalized cancer research, so genomic research for personalized cancer medicine, mm-hmm. and helping those researchers accelerate the speed of their research through cloud patterns,
right.
through getting these pipelines up on the cloud. So I have several big clients all over the world, and I've been you know, working with them for a number of years now. And then when COVID hit, it was just a really fascinating time to be in this because some of them literally stopped all their cancer research and converted to COVID testing labs. Mm-hmm. So I was actually involved in a project with one client, only peripherally, but still I got to look at the pipeline and, you know, try to give recommendations around, in this case it was a Google Cloud pipeline. They converted all their cancer research genomics labs to COVID testing labs in like 2 weeks.
It's
just fascinating. Fast. Yeah.
We are in an unprecedented time in the sense that we can, I think in near real time, do genetic analysis of the virus for every case, for every test.
Well, you know, it's super nuanced because mm-hmm. there's all kinds of different testing. You know, there's testing to see whether or not a person has the virus. And mm-hmm. there's different kinds of testing depending on if they test your saliva or your blood or your tissue or whatever. And then there's testing as to if you get COVID, how is that manifested in your body,
right?
And what areas of the body? And that kind of testing is not so much DNA, it's RNA testing,
right?
That's further down the chain. And so, being so involved with these research organizations, one, I actually have employee status, even though I'm a contractor, mm-hmm. which has just been fascinating because I have access to all their, you know, just emerging collaborative research. For example, I was on one podcast where they had 12 different slides, 12 different scientists around the world tracing the life cycle of COVID in the lungs genetically, and
right.
12 different ways of testing. Honestly, there's not a better time for me as a data cloud architect to be working this. It's just, it's inconvenient. I need to sleep. Let me put it that way.
But I also appreciate, so often we're immersed in technology. It's easy to ignore the real world impacts. And here you are dealing with the crisis of our times, and your technical skills are accelerating the ability for us to deal with this.
Well, and there's a number of weird things this year, mm-hmm. And I already have an unusual life, but this year really is just topping it. I got COVID.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't know for sure because there were no tests.
Right.
but I ended up at the ER and it was suspected and I had all the symptoms and all that. So literally while I was
struggling.
Well, I'm still here, right? But it was just so surreal because
yeah.
I literally was struggling with the symptoms while I was advising on that pipeline. And I said to the client, is there any way I can get a test? Can you mail me out some sort of tube so I can spit in it? Because
right.
I can't get one here. So it's just a weird year, do you know?
Mm-hmm. No kidding. So the pipeline is getting test data into the system. Like this is not for shipping oil. Like what's a pipeline in this scenario?
So I'll just tell you the particular client. So this was mm-hmm. for the Broad Institute at MIT and Harvard. And,
okay.
To be completely transparent, I really didn't do a lot because honestly, I was pretty sick with COVID and I didn't want to create a dependency on me. But
right.
they said, hey, you're a GCP architect. Can you look at this? So the team just, got together and said, hey, we have the ability to do these PCR tests because we have the labs, the wet labs, basically. So
right.
there was a quick decision made. And in terms of the pipelining or the cloud aspect, it was pretty simple. It's basically they just needed to have the equivalent of huge spreadsheets ingested because the spreadsheets have, the barcode identifier on the spit tube, basically, and then the hospital and some of them metadata, but identification of the physical sample.
Right.
And then you put that into the system, then it goes into the wet lab and you have that as the metadata. And then when the results are processed, you generate a report and then that report has to be securely delivered to whatever facility. So in terms of pipelining, it actually wasn't a complex problem because sort of a known pattern. Ingest data, process ABC,
right.
put the result out. And, props to the team. It was a super small team. And the cloud portion of it was done in 7 days by 3 or 4 people. It's really exceptional people and all serverlessly. So it was a pretty awesome project. And again, I'm such a, I need to pay more attention to my physical self. I was so annoyed that I was like, okay, I'm going to have to go to the ER. I can't help.
And yeah.
Like,
and you really wanted to work on the project more than.
Yeah, exactly. Well, literally when I was in the ER, I told the doctor, once I found out I wasn't, it looked like I would be okay. I said, will you please get me out of here so I can actually get you some tests? Because
right.
they didn't have a test for me.
Wow.
It was kind of just a weird scenario,
And this must have been, I'm presuming this was early on. I think tests are more available these days.
Yeah, I have to always be the first mover.
Yeah, yeah. You have a history of that, Lynn.
Yeah.
We've known each other a long time.
I got it in March when there was nothing, no tests, no treatment. I talked to video doctors in San Francisco who said, good luck, we don't know.
Oh, that's a great feeling, right? And so are these automated labs now that are taking the samples and actually doing the testing?
Yeah. So what the Broad did, and again, I just really want to be clear here. It's the Broad and
yes.
me more reporting the news. They were able to test at scale because, they're basically an incubator for cancer bioinformatics research. Mm-hmm. So they have all these different labs. And they just put out a report, I think it was the end of June, they had tested 250,000 residents of Massachusetts. And one of the things that they did that I'm just so proud of is they developed this high-risk testing protocol. So they connected with the retirement homes, and they were one of the first areas in the United States to offer testing to the employees at the retirement homes in a really regular basis, like every 3 to 5 days, mm-hmm. which is a proven strategy of reducing mortality, because it's just such a, you know, really deadly combination. You have all these young people working in retirement homes who are often asymptomatic.
Right.
And if you don't test them regularly, then, you know, unfortunately the population that's vulnerable gets infected and then they, you know, die at really high rates.
Yeah. So, well, it's certainly in Canada, it's been the care homes that have just taken, been brutalized. It's horrifying, really. And worse still, that it's the caregivers that are most likely the source.
Yeah.
You know, the folks who dedicated their lives, whose careers is to keeping those, keeping their patients well, and very likely were the ones that infected them.
Well, again, you know, year of strange occurrences. My mom is 82 mm-hmm. and she's in a retirement home in Fargo, North Dakota. And by the time that the virus got there, which took longer because everything takes longer to get to Fargo, right? they already had implemented a protocol
right.
that was similar to what the Broad was supporting in Massachusetts. And so in her care home, they test the support people every 3 to 5 days.
Right.
And although they've had 16 positive support people, they've had only one positive resident and nobody died.
What a great story. Yeah.
And I mean, you know, really that just sort of tells like what is possible with the cloud enabling speed in terms of processing.
Right. And just understanding the nature of spread and how those things actually work. For us here in Vancouver, they just lock them down. Well, I think the biggest issue was that often these care workers worked at several different homes.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were moving around and they stopped that. You would only work for one. But even then it was somewhat too late. For some harder hit areas, it was quite devastating. But I'm glad mom's go okay.
I mean, it was a nightmare because literally the home across the street, it was that scenario before they did the same thing with the workers.
Yeah.
54 residents died across the street from her. 54. Yeah. So again, it's just this year has been, you know, one of like, am I alive? Is my mm-hmm. family alive? Great.
Yeah. Well, it certainly seems to be refocusing.
You know,
all of our priorities shuffled, or more relevantly, we have scrutinized every priority, both, you know, personal, community, and our work, to just have a chance to say what's important here.
Where, you are so much more eloquent than I am. I just say, "Am I alive?
Am I alive?" but life is a complicated thing. It's also what's important in my life, right? That I was happy to stay home and be near my family. And stay as a unit. That was actually an important part of that. That the cooking together has been a feature, you know, has been one of the pleasures of all being together, as frightening as things might be.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I moved across the country mm-hmm. To be relatively closer to my mom after 20 years in California. And, you know, I wanted to kind of slowly get integrated into what was my home, come back to my home and meet people here. But, you know, again, I got my wish because, you know, I was basically sequestered into my new apartment for months.
Right.
And just now we're starting to come out. So, you know.
Hi, I've been your neighbor for months.
Well, I have a lot of windows. And it's actually really funny because I know some of my neighbors because we wave and we have like, you know, I thought, okay, we're going to start holding up, like, here's my Skype name, Skype me.
Nice. That's a good idea. Just to stay sufficiently far apart. So I've always heard that these DNA data, like these kinds of things, like they're really large. Is the per sample data set huge?
How much data? So one of the things that I talk about now is, you know, big data is kind of passe. Yeah, it's genomic scale data. So for example, I've been doing a lot of work with the Broad, and this is public information, just to give your listeners a sense of how big. The Broad is putting in, on average, every day, 17 terabytes of data into the Google Cloud.
Wow. How many tests is that?
This is pre-COVID, so things have really mm-hmm. changed now. That was their cancer research. So the thing that's you know, I've come to learn, and I'm in a learning path here because I didn't study bioinformatics, but, you know, there's basically two kinds of research, and the kind of research that is sort of current is research around the potential to address genomic changes that you inherit. And so that you would be assessing people's DNA. So you look at groups of DNA, and that's big enough. I mean, it's 3 billion letters, but it's not a single string, because right. The way it works is you cut it into little groups, and then you assess them over and over and over, because when you analyze if it's a T or an A or a C or a G, it's a light process, you excite the I don't know, I'm getting beyond what I know, but I've seen the machines that do it. Basically, every time you scan each scan, and you have to scan four times for the TAGC, it reduces the quality. So it's a probabilistic result. So it's not just like 3 billion one time.
Right.
You have to do it over and over, and it's a matrix calculation, even for the DNA.
Right.
So that's like the first level, and that's kind of like really active right now in the research community. The thing that I've been working on is sort of the next level, which is epigenomic, which is what happens to your body once you're born. And that's more like, what are the proteins that are actually in your body? So that comes through the DNA to the RNA to the protein synthesis. Mm-hmm. So it's like looking at the impact of environment, of the quality of air, looking at the impact of food, looking at the impact of maybe diseases that you've had. And it's the movement towards personalized medicine.
Yeah.
So sort of the front end of it is what they call single cell analysis, single cell RNA analysis. So that literally is mapping the RNA sequence of every cell in your body. It's like mind-blowingly big.
Just to even consider that you might be able to do that.
Yeah. It's crazy how much. Obviously, they have to do subsets right now. But one of the last contracts I was working on with the Broad is working with a partner in London, the Imperial College of London, to help them to start to be able to use some of the Broad's tools. Because, of course, obviously, anybody who's trying to do this is running out of capacity on-prem and has to go to the cloud.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, really, really cutting edge, because the price of sequencing has, you know, dropped much more than Moore's Law over time. So this wasn't even thinkable like more than 3 years ago. This is really the cutting edge. But anyway, so they're working on creating RNA data sets, single cell data sets in the brain around Alzheimer's.
Wow.
Yeah. So again, it's like, seriously, it's so inconvenient of sleep that I have to sleep, that I have to age, that I have to, you know, I just like, this is such an exciting time to work in this stuff, you know?
And Lynn, I'm going to interrupt for one moment for this very important message. Going to the cloud enables remote work for your Windows 10 machines. But once those machines are out there and on the go, how are you going to manage them? Group Policy or an MDM service like Intune is a good start to manage Windows 10, but you're going to need more power. You'll still need to secure those machines' applications, OS settings, users, Java, and browsers. With so much attack surface for your remote work machines, you owe it to yourself to check out Policy Pack. Only Policy Pack hooks into and enhances both Group Policy and MDM to enable you to remove local admin rights and overcome UAC prompts, block unknownware, maintain and lock down applications and OS settings, configure the Windows 10 start screen and file associations, and manage all your browsers. Learn how thousands of other admins enhance the management of on-prem and remote work Windows 10 machines with Policy Pack. Come to policypack.com/remotework to learn more. That's policypack.com/remotework. Policy Pack, securing your standards. And listeners of this podcast are eligible to win a free copy of the Cybex Wiley book entitled MDM, Fundamentals, Security, and the Modern Desktop, Using Intune, Autopilot, and Azure to Manage, Deploy, and Secure Windows 10 by Jeremy Moskowitz, Enterprise Mobility MVP. Simply pick Runaz Radio in the dropdown when you visit policypack.com/remotework. Good luck. And we hope you win. And we're back. It's Run As Radio. I'm Richard Campbell. That's Lynn Langit. And we're talking about this genomic scale cloud analysis problem, specifically around the pandemic, but obviously, you know, been working in the various cancer aspects as well. And it is sort of an unprecedented time that now the issue is just managing the sheer volume of data. What kind of analysis do you need to do once you've got a genetic map? Like, what are they looking for?
Well, they're looking for a variance of significance. Okay. So everything is probabilistic, mm-hmm. and machine learning comes into play. So again, you have the hugest volumes of data. You have the most messy data.
Yes.
Because, for example, I learned things working with Broad like, don't eat a pork sandwich before you get sequenced because you'll get pig DNA.
Oh, so my goodness. That's awesome.
You cracked me up, man. So they have all these quality checks where they check for, and they ask you, like, what did you eat to make sure that there, because, it's called a wet lab process, right? And so it's the perfect storm because you have all the messiness that is life, right? And data from life. And then you have massive amounts of data. And then you have incredibly complex probabilistic machine learning computation.
I'm just getting over this idea that we can literally genetically tell that you are what you eat.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's astonishing. But yeah, and the tests are not perfect. So you're dealing with, because as you described, the testing process is destructive to the sample. So you only get to do so many tests and you want to test multiple times because there's always inconsistencies. And there is genetic damage. There isn't a consistent pattern to everything. So what cells were you testing? What state were they in? Did you have a pork sandwich? Like, it's just an extraordinary, the chances, you're never going to get this 100% result. And I think it's something we're seeing folks wish for in this pandemic is this, I just want certainty.
Right.
Tell me if I've got it. Tell me if I'm immune. And it's like, it's more complicated than that. It's never that precise. There isn't one vaccine. There isn't even one version of this virus. And there's not one, and everybody's experience with it is going to be different.
Yeah, that's just really well put. Very accurate.
Yeah. I'm glad you're working in the problem space, but I understand it's got to be frustrating too, because you don't get to say things like, it's like this, it does that. It's all probabilistic. And that's sort of the reality of machine learning as a whole. We always say, probability of confidence. And we already know that humans are terrible with looking at confidence numbers.
Yeah, it's kind of challenging to have conversations with some of my non-technical friends because they are looking to me to be authoritative because people want answers.
Right.
And when I try to explain to them the complexity of the solutions, just very, very specifically, when will we have a vaccine? And I said, that's a stupid question. Because there won't be a vaccine. It's just not even a, and I'm usually not that rude about it, but do you know what I mean? So because it is such a complex problem space, even, in the treatment side, because I have actually more hope on the treatment side that we will design personalized treatments that will work. For example, one of the things that is really interesting, they're finding out that in some patients, COVID will present like a blood cancer almost. And so it's infecting the IL-6 pathway, which is a known disease problem with lymphoma. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are many treatments for lymphoma. And depending on what type of lymphoma you have, it can be very much like you can live a long, very productive life with, innovative personalized treatments. And these drugs have already been approved, which is really important.
Right.
Yeah.
So as soon as the infection presents with that leukemia kind of model or lymphoma kind of model, it's like, oh, we have a treatment series for this.
Well, that's what, it's one of the things that is looking really promising. Mm-hmm. There's about seven of them, but so in generally the treatments that are being worked on have two classes. One are, drugs that are new for human consumption, which are going to take a lot longer because they have to go through the whole FDA approval process, and then ones that already have been approved. How that manifests for your listeners who are probably wondering if they tuned into the wrong show here because we're talking so much about bioinformatics in cloud pipelines is the number of QC checks, so the amount of computation. So this is kind of an interesting thing to think about. Mm-hmm. And I think some industries, I've seen it in like fintech in New York, for example, like working with quants, the quality of the algorithm before they spend the money, okay? Mm-hmm. How many times do we verify it? What level of precision? It's kind of analogous.
Yeah, it makes sense to me because they also have to make a decision in a certain amount of time to execute on the opportunity.
Right. Yeah, so if you contrast my experience in fintech is we have to go faster.
Yes.
And in healthcare, we have to have a certain levels of precision
right.
in our data.
More certainty.
Yeah. And reproducibility
right.
too, if it's early on.
Yeah. But never with 100% certainty. That is not a thing.
No.
But even to get into the 90th percentile, which is, I think that's even rarer too, right? To get even that high.
Well, again, it depends on where you are in the research pipeline,
mm-hmm.
right? Are you researching, you know, just to research? Are you researching with tissue? Are you researching with animals? Are you in a human trial? You know, there's different levels of tolerances that are acceptable in terms of quality control. And that translates into cloud compute costs because you have to have higher levels of precision in your, you know, execution of your machine learning algorithm, for example. So these are really different problems for our industry, I think, for most people in our industry. I know I didn't work with them, you know, when I was writing indexes on SQL Server
mm-hmm. yeah.
10 years ago. This that is... wasn't the same thing, you know.
Well, and it is interesting to have, you know, gotten to a place in your career where you are looking at the overall problem and saying, you know, how does my technical skill help with this science problem? It's very, very mm-hmm. removed from, can you improve the performance of this query? Into the much vaguer, you know, we have this computational problem. What can your technology help us with?
Well, yes and no, because I mean, one of the things that my team did working with the group in London is they a lot of the people in bioinformatics haven't had the opportunity to benefit from some of the industry optimizations around compute. And
mm-hmm.
so a pattern that I see in bioinformatics is making Docker containers that are like VMs.
Right.
That are two gigs or 3 gigs. And in fact, that's what they had. And so, you know, that was, I love it when there's low hanging fruit and you can just say.
Yeah, they were simply using container technology the wrong way.
Yeah, yeah. And you can really provide value, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I'm trying to leverage, my experience in patterns around DevOps, because bioinformatics is moving so fast right now. They're just scrambling to get it going.
Right.
That it's fulfilling in that there's always something that you can add if you have experience in cloud compute patterns.
Well, and every time you have a day where you made a difference in getting something done, much less made a difference in the pandemic, whatever small piece that may be, that's a good day.
Yeah.
Automatically, I'm generally happy when I come away from I helped someone today, much less I helped on something as world changing as this. But it is interesting that after you get over what this data represents and what they're trying to do, it's still a compute problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's still how are you organizing data, how are you distributing it at multiple compute points, how are you utilizing available processing power. So you got to sort of dig into that brass tacks on this. I mean, what are the techs are they using? Is Hadoop still a player in this scale?
No, it's Spark. They're moving towards Spark. It's really interesting because, you know, I have this history with Hadoop way back to when I was an employee at Microsoft mm-hmm. in 2011. And Hadoop was kind of a Cloudera was starting and Microsoft was building HD Insight. And I was really interested in it because I have this background in database systems. I was trying to learn it. And so I benefited from the fact that when I left Microsoft to be a consultant, first thing I did is I went to New Jersey and took a 5-day class in Hadoop, which was quite a shocker.
Wow.
From somebody coming from the Microsoft world. I never had used Linux. I never had used Java. Nothing. And I ended up from that experience being able to translate for customers when Hadoop would be a good value and when it wouldn't. And I ended up making a very popular set of courses. It's both on YouTube free and then it's at LinkedIn Learning and like hundreds of thousands of people have watched this
mm-hmm.
because the experience I had was useful for people because
sure. it was your learning experience too. You were teaching from the context of I am learning this.
Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, so fast forward to now, I really dug into it because I didn't understand it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Spark generally, I'm oversimplifying here, but is Hadoop that runs in memory rather than on disk.
Okay.
So it's the same principles of managing a distributed data cluster. And so that has really benefited me in this industry as bioinformatics moves to Spark. In fact, one of the things that my team did early, it was 3 years ago now, we worked with a team in Australia and they had a Spark library that they were running on-prem, and to ask a single question costs 500 hours.
Hours.
And yeah, 500 hours just to ask one time. And it would only be useful like half the time. Because you know what I mean? It was so the team was like, oh, you're the cloud architect. Can you do something with this? And it took a while because it was early on. But my team and I built one of the first data lake patterns. It was on Amazon. We did Kubernetes clusters because Spark was Kubernetes enabled conveniently right around that time. And we got it down to 10 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah.
And this is, again, this is that great cloud story of, and you're harnessing a huge amount of compute for a brief amount of time.
Yep. Yep.
Which is only makes sense in the cloud model. You would never own that much compute, and because you can't use it all the time. It's expensive. But to be able to rent it by the minute, run that case for that brief amount of time, and then let it all go.
Well, it's particularly suited to this work because you have task areas in the pipelines that are more complex. So this burstable compute is just perfect fit for it, basically.
Right. As long as you can break out the individual parts so that it can be run across more processes, you can make it work and you can go fast.
That would be the tricky part.
500 hours to 10 minutes is a pretty good scale, right? You put that one on the resume, like there's a good day.
Yeah, did a few keynotes about that one.
Yeah, no kidding. But it's also part of taking apart the problem and figuring out, like, what do we actually need to do here? Where are the points of separation that we can utilize more compute power?
Yeah, it's to me, it's a kind of a functional programming problem because a lot of these folks start with R on their laptop.
Right.
And in fact, we ran into that in London. And of course, R is not multi-threaded natively. And so, you know, it's not taking the tasks and just putting them in a container and go. It's the tasks themselves have to be rewritten.
Yeah.
And, you know, that again is another hard part of this problem. Places like the Broad are trying to create tool sets. They have it's called the Genomic Analysis Toolkit. It's a Java library. It has, I think, 150 different tools.
Wow.
But then again, you have the problem of how do researchers globally learn cloud?
Yeah.
Learn Docker. Learn these tools.
Because these are folks that are educated in the science of this. These are biologists, right?
Right.
And so you're asking them to do some fairly technical things. I presume the Broad has a bunch of computing scientists and engineers working there, as well as the scientists that are focused on genetics.
They do, but you know, I wanted to talk about another sort of aspect of this because it translates, I think, to any sort of paradigm shift in an industry. Because I see genomic scale data coming to other verticals like IoT and other ones. So again, for your listeners who are saying, are they going to stop talking about diseases? It's about data, people. But anyway, the point is having proper educational resources. You know, you mentioned in my introduction that in addition to building things, I teach. And of course, like everybody else, all my teaching has moved to online platforms. And so I have 25-30 courses on LinkedIn Learning, have had 4 million viewers. So, you know, a lot of experience. And I've taught technology as you have for many years. Mm-hmm. So how this translates in this paradigm shift is to create vertical specific training.
Interesting.
So yeah. So one of the things that I did for the Broad and really for the greater bioinformatics community is I created an open source online course, GCP for Bioinformatics. So the idea was to provide domain-specific examples. And again, this is very funny in bioinformatics. Their Hello World, when I was starting, I was like, okay, let me run my Hello World. Well, it takes 5 hours. I said, what? What?
Don't worry, we're in this space. That's wicked fast.
Right. So one of the things I literally have been doing is every time I find a bioinformatics tool, I try to either use, make, or test a Hello World that takes less than 15 minutes.
Wow. Yeah, that's a great metric. That's been my magic number for a lot of large-scale things. I like the way I've always described hitting the 15-minute rule is it's enough time to go get another cup of coffee. It's not enough time to get started on something else.
Yeah.
Right? Like I built testing infrastructure for websites that took 15 minutes because a programmer would push up a feature, you know, would check in.
Yep.
And then,
yep.
You know, go get a cup of coffee. When they come back, if their test results are back, they'll fix it right there when it's still in their head.
Mm-hmm.
And if they, and if it takes longer than that, then they get on the next thing, and then it, goodness knows when stuff's going to get fixed. But I've got to think, when you're doing analytical work like this, you get that same problem. If it takes too long, if you're pursuing a thread of intuition around some data, those delays, you lose those threads. So, you know, you're hitting that right amount of time, so you're still thinking about it when the results come back.
100%. I mean, the other thing that I've been working on, and this is, you know, I keep saying it publicly, so I have to do it. a few years ago, I'd say about 2 years ago now, I really was thinking about, it's an Australia problem, you know, where we got it to 10 minutes. To relate to this problem in Australia, they got some DevOps people. And they were having difficulty implementing our 10-minute solution because it had Kubernetes, it had, you know, all this AWS CloudFormation templates, all these things they didn't know, right?
Right. They, and they need to, they're trying to build a pipeline to create and configure all of those things.
Yeah. So it was the, it works on the developer's machine, but when the developer's not there, we don't know how to do it, right?
Right.
So I made training videos. I made everything, right? And these are really solid, you know, PhD, well-educated people. And I thought, okay, there's something wrong with the industry, not the people. And so I kind of went back to my days of business analytics. And I thought, okay, when I made data warehouses, this is really dating me, how do you communicate them? You know, because I used to work with a SQL Server analysis services way back when, wrote books about it. You have effective visualizations, right?
Yes.
And so, you know, as an architect, I love to draw the, what I call just-in-time, lightweight architecture, agile architecture. But none of the tools that I was using seemed to be good enough. Like the flat diagrams were, they'd get out of date or you couldn't actually build from it. And I was like, I want to read a book about this. I want to read a book about, you know, tools for visualizing cloud systems. And I couldn't find one.
Interesting.
And I was like, okay, I have to write one.
Well, obviously, right? That's the only, the number of things I've made because I wanted it and didn't already exist.
Right.
So it's the only way to get things to come into existence is just to make them.
So it's kind of an obsession with me, this idea of the picture or pictures of the pipeline. In fact, I did a couple of keynotes last year in Europe to, you know, forcing function to get me to work on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and working with my clients. I mean, one of the things I have to tell you, this is a really small thing, but, you know, you talk about, you know, when you make an improvement. When the Broad put out their COVID pipeline on their system, which is called Terra.bio, it's a web UI that happens to sit on top of GCP, but it's designed to run on more than one cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And they had their COVID, one of the ways you would process COVID data. They had a single page graphic of what the pipeline looked like on their reference example. Because
right.
I had, just as a backstory, I had reworked with them their Hello World examples and just implored them to put in some visuals because there was just too many steps for people to hold in their head. And I said, just try these visuals out. You'll get better adoption. And then when it really mattered, the team for COVID put in a graphic. And I said, oh yay. You know, and I don't know. Did that really help? I want to think so. I don't know.
But it's important, right, to help people grasp something, to give them the impetus to get over the hurdle of understanding, is to give them something that they can grab onto.
Well, you know, it's funny, you know, I don't do it anymore, but for years and years, as you mentioned in the intro, I did, you know, teaching kids programming. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that the whole foundation of teaching the fourth through eighth graders was they would draw the picture first.
Right.
And then it was the logo style, then the turtle would draw it, and then they would write it in the Java library. And so, you know, again, that was just really kind of pounded into me that you have to first visualize what you're building, that the visual is sort of the proto language or the pre-language. And to really nerd out, I have a degree in linguistics and not computer science. So,
right.
So you know, this kind of,
course
this
you're
kind
thinking
of,
like that, Lynn.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, well, you taught a lot of kids to program too, but I really appreciate the work you're doing these days. This is wildly important. And it just, I feel like as this pandemic wraps up, which is clearly going to be a while yet, we've built a set of skills now that are going to be useful for a lot of large data sets in the future.
Well, that's my hope. You know, one of the things I'm really excited, I'm really honored that I was invited back into the Microsoft fold as a regional director here just recently. And, you know, first of all, I hadn't had the opportunity to have a client that wanted to work on Azure. And just very fortunately, I have had one now. And so it was super convenient that I, you know, got invited to be part of this program because I'm actually literally right now doing some work researching what Azure has done on genomics. And it's been really fun and interesting. I'm such a curious person. I hadn't really worked in the Azure cloud for a couple of years, and it's really great to see, you know, all the improvements.
It's evolving.
Yeah.
Well, Lynn, a really fun conversation. Thanks for spending some time with me and sharing the great work you're doing. And well, we're both RDs, so I guess we're going to run into each other some more if and when we actually get to be in the same place together.
Great. Thank you. Wonderful to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, too. And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.